This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Just minutes after delegates to the Republican National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, formally awarded him the party's nomination Monday, U.S. President Donald Trump took the stage to make nearly an hour-long speech in an unannounced but highly expected appearance. He told his audience that the Democrats are trying to steal election without providing evidence for the remarks, speculating on the use of mail-in ballots designed to protect against the spread of COVID-19. Mr. Trump said the only way the Democrats can defeat him at the polls in November is through a rigged election. As part of a significantly scaled back proceeding in response to the coronavirus pandemic, only a small fraction of the total Republican delegates took part in nominating Mr. Trump and Vice President Mike Pence for a second term. In a break in tradition, President Trump is said to he spoke to delegates on each of the 4 days of the convention. Usually, the nominee does not speak until he formally accepts the nomination on the final day of the event. After Monday's speech, the president flew to North Carolina, a town of Mills River, with his daughter, Ivanka. In remarks there, he declared the great American comeback is underway. Mr. Trump is expected to formally accept on Thursday in a speech from the White House to be followed by fireworks. Talks between West African envoys and Mali's new military rulers Monday failed to yield an agreement on how the country should return to civilian rule after last week's coup, according to negotiators. Separately, both sides said that the ousted president, Ibrahim, whose return to office had initially been demanded by the regional bloc, no longer wished to govern. Deadlock on the key issue of civilian transition emerged after the fledgling junta denied it wanted a 3-year handover period by a soldier. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Northern Ireland police say 10 people arrested last week in an investigation of the militant Irish nationalist New IRA group have been charged on a range of offenses from directing terrorism to conspiracy to possess explosives. The New IRA, one of a small number of active militant groups opposed to Northern Ireland's 1998 peace deal, have been behind some of the most sporadic attacks that have continued, including the murder of a journalist, Lyra McKee, last year. The 10 people, 8 men and 2 women, were charged with a total of 39 offenses as a result of a coordinated investigation with police in Scotland, Ireland, and Britain that was also assisted by Britain's MI5 domestic intelligence agency. The New IRA, far smaller than the Irish Republican Army, which disarmed after the 1998 peace accord. The group was formed in 2012 after 3 of the 4 main militant nationalist groups merged, first time since a peace deal that most of the nationalist groups still intent on violence came together under one leadership. It's also been responsible for the separate killings of 2 prison officers since then. In the state of Wisconsin, the governor, Tony Evers, is deploying the National Guard to the city of Kenosha to prevent violence after the police shooting of a black man. Jacob Blake was shot in the back and seriously wounded Sunday evening as he leaned into a car with his 3 children inside. Reports say Blake was in stable condition Monday at a Milwaukee hospital. Police were reported to be responding to a domestic dispute, although circumstances surrounding the shooting are still unclear. The 3 officers, whose race was not made public, have been placed on administrative leave. Shooting sparked a night of violence Sunday night. Officials have announced an overnight curfew there for Monday night. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Monday that the United States will ensure Israel's military advantage in the Middle East under any potential U.S. arms deals with the United Arab Emirates. Pompeo said the United States has a legal requirement to honor its military agreements with Israel. He made the remark Monday after meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The top U.S. diplomat's trip to the Middle East comes after Washington helped broker the Israel-UAE deal earlier this month, a pact that Netanyahu said heralds a new era for the region. The Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas said the deal is a betrayal of Palestinians. The Israel-UAE deal is seen as breaking a tradition among most Arab countries not to make peace with Israel until Israel and the Palestinians make peace. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 25th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyans took to the streets Monday to demand accountability for COVID-19 funds.
70% of funding to healthcare comes from donors here in Nakuru. Because of theft that is happening in Kenya, donors are withdrawing their support.
South Africa's president sends a strongly worded letter to the ruling ANC over looting of COVID-19 funds. Food insecure Zimbabweans turn to lockdown relief kitchens, who burned down the headquarters of Mozambique's Canal newspaper. And Amnesty International says the Nigerian government is not doing enough to curtail insecurity.
What we are saying is that the government is not doing enough. Because if you are doing enough, then we should not continue to record this high number of deaths that we are recording.
And Senegalese health professionals exchange ideas with their Gambian counterparts amid rising COVID-19 cases in the Gambia. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Civil society activists in Kenya took to the streets yesterday, Monday, to demand that the government takes action against officials from the Ministry of Health accused of misuse of COVID-19 pandemic funds. The Ministry of Health is accused of allegedly stealing and selling COVID-19 kits to neighboring countries and private hospitals in Kenya. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, opposition leaders have asked the government to form an investigative committee to look into the allegations.
At least 25 lobby groups have teamed up to petition the government to put up measures that will assure Kenyans transparency and credibility in the Ministry of Health while dealing with COVID-19 funds. Already, the Ministry of Health has distanced itself from the allegations that they have sold protective equipment donated by donor community to combat COVID-19 pandemic to the neighboring countries and Kenya's private hospitals. Kenyans have taken it to the streets, accusing the government of doing business while Kenyans are suffering. Masese Kamunche, a human rights activist in Nakuru County, led residents in engaging police in running battles yesterday, Monday, as they demanded for accountability of COVID-19 funds in the county.
70% of funding to healthcare comes from donors here in Nakuru. Level 1 and level 2 of healthcare services are 100% supported through donor funding. Because of theft that is happening in this county, because of theft that is happening in Kenya, donors are withdrawing their support. And as we said, when that withdrawal happens, it's the poor people who will die. Comrades, power!
Another activist from Kisumu County, Boniface Akach, speaking during yesterday, Monday's demos, said that as young people, they will not allow Kenyans to suffer because of graft, and asked for accused persons on corruption at the Ministry of Health to resign.
This is part of a national campaign that is made up of Kenyans and anybody in this country who is tired, who is mad, and who wants to take action about the continued rampant looting of public resources, about the looting of COVID funds. Anybody who is tired and mad enough and ready to come out and save this country. As young people whose future of this country is in our hands, we are not going to let Kenya die for us. We are ready to die for Kenya.
On the other hand, the opposition co-leader Musalia Mudavadi has asked President Uhuru Kenyatta to probe the theft allegations at the Ministry of Health. Mudavadi said that Kenya is at the verge of losing support from donor community if proper measures are not put in place to fight graft at the Ministry of Health.
The only appropriate mechanism via which to get to the bottom of what is ailing the health sector is for the president to appoint a judicial commission of inquiry. Only such inquiry will soften the hearts of our development partners who threaten to abandon us at our hour of most need because of our insatiable dishonesty.
Already, Kenya has received 220 billion Kenya shillings from development partners to help fight COVID-19 pandemic. Demands for accountability in the use of millions of dollars allocated for COVID-19 interventions continue to gather momentum, with the Commission's Administrative Justice calling on government to address the issue. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has written a strongly worded letter to his ruling African National Congress ANC party, saying it stands accused of being the top perpetrator in the massive looting of COVID-19 funds that has triggered national anger. The Special Crimes Investigating Unit is probing hundreds of companies. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
In the letter to the party he leads, Ramaphosa says party members and government officials fingered in the COVID-19 corruption saga have committed unforgivable betrayal. He says there are strong allegations that tender for COVID-19 relief and personal protective equipment have been irregularly given to individuals associated with the ANC and civil servants. In some cases, companies have been awarded tenders based on friendship, conflicted relationships, family connections, and promises of kickbacks. Political analyst Kaya Stolle says while the letter is unusual and raises critical issues, it will achieve very little.
It's an important political step, and it's an important for public perception, but I don't think that any of the people that are planning on stealing a rand or two tomorrow are now going to suddenly say, oops, there's been a letter released, let me think differently. It just doesn't work like that.
Ramaphosa is challenging his party to admit it remains deeply implicated in the corruption saga that has exploited a grave health, social and economic crisis. Another political analyst, Karima Brown, says while Ramaphosa is talking tough and candidly, the corruption problem in the party is larger than a mere letter.
Every single day, we are inundated with allegations and, in fact, some instances, hard proof of senior ANC leaders that are involved and implicated in corruption. The African National Congress's DNA has become affected by corruption.
Ramaphosa wants all party and government officials facing corruption allegations to account to the party's integrity commission or face disciplinary processes. He is proposing suspension of those refusing to voluntarily step down. The ANC president also wants party leaders and public representatives to undergo a lifestyle audit to see if the wealth they have was legally obtained. Ahmed Kathrada Foundationist Nishan Balton says the ANC should give thanks to COVID-19 restrictions that have restrained South Africans from flooding the streets to vent their anger over the massive corruption.
You possibly would have seen thousands of South Africans into the streets demonstrating that anger. What I think is different now is the scale and the depth of this anger. What is at stake is not just the looting from COVID-19, it's the entire program of democracy, and we can't allow that.
Ramaphosa says he has ordered the Special Investigating Unit to probe all tender fraud involving COVID-19 funds and act without fear or favor towards anyone found in the wrong. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Zimbabweans had been struggling to get by with the economy in shambles even before the coronavirus pandemic. Now, amid growing food insecurity, charities in the capital, Harare, have opened relief kitchens to provide free meals to thousands, most of them informal traders unable to earn money because of pandemic restrictions. Columbus Mavunga has more.
People queue outside the house of Samantha Shingrai Mutoroki, waiting to be served porridge for breakfast in Seke, about 30 minutes southeast of Harare. The suburb has one of the highest number of cases of food insecurity, according to official data of those affected by the corona pandemic lockdown. Murozoki says, after being unable to return to South Africa when the lockdown started, she decided to help those struggling with hunger. The 35-year-old woman now runs a relief kitchen that provides two daily meals to those unable to feed themselves in the neighborhood where she grew up.
I just want people to go to bed with a satiated tummy. That's all I want. I want, with a forecast in the future, I want people to gain self-sustenance. I want a population that says, in the event of a contagion or disaster, we can be able to pick ourselves up because we've gained skills maybe to to make soap or to make cooking products, anything that gives them an upper hand when it comes to poverty. So social development projects are what I have in plan.
She started the project with her own food, then well-wishers chipped in, and Murozoki now feeds about 3,000 people daily. Post the lockdown, Murozoki says she wants to train people to start income-generating projects. Sheba Dimbua is one of the beneficiaries. The 53-year-old informal trader walks 30 minutes twice a day to get food to look after his three children. He says he has been expecting government assistance.
Things have been very tough. So Samantha actually, you know, but when I heard about her, I thought maybe, you know, it was a joke. But when I came here, it was actually reality. Every day I've been coming here. So things have been very tough. And, you know, as lockdown started, we thought maybe government was going to chip in to give us assistance. But to that effect, the government has not been forthcoming. But up to now, nothing has been done.
Finance Minister Mutuli Ncube says the government is aware that informal traders who constitute the bulk of Zimbabwe's employment are affected by the lockdown, which was imposed in late March to contain the pandemic.
So we are not short of money in terms of the support to the vulnerable Zimbabweans. In fact, at the moment, we are waiting to reach our target of 1 million people who are vulnerable, who need to be registered, and we're appealing people to come forward and register with social welfare because we have the budget.
Maria Parue is one of those benefiting from a $3 a month grant from the government. The 66-year-old widow depends on Samantha's relief kitchen to make up the gap. She says, we get funds from the Minister of Social Welfare, 300 bond, but it's not enough to buy 10 kilograms of cornmeal. That's why you see me here, she adds. Cornmeal is used to make Zimbabwe's staple food, a thick porridge known as sadza or isichwala, which is served with a relish. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 25th. The executive editor of the independent Canal de Mozambique, or Mozambique Channel newspaper, says he believes the torching of his newspaper's headquarters could be related to his attempted kidnapping last December 31st. Mateus Guente told VOA he was in court on Monday to answer charges brought by the government for violating state secrets. The Associated Press Monday quoted the Center for Democracy as saying that Canal had reported days earlier about bribery and the efforts of prominent Mozambicans to win control of part of the fuel retail business worth millions of dollars. Guente says the Mozambican government is responding aggressively and with violence against the press for its reporting of the Islamic militant's insurgency in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province.
Yesterday at 9 Maputo time, unknown people, they break into our headquarters and they burn it down. They use petrol and they burn it down completely. All the computers, all our office materials became onto dust.
The article says that the burning could be linked to some article your paper carried recently. Can you tell us exactly about that article?
I'm not sure, and I'm not going to own that line because I'm not sure if it's related with a specific article that we wrote. But this I can say. I think that this action is related with the attempt of my kidnapping on 31 December last year. I escaped from being kidnapped, and there has become a current of a press against me and against the newspaper. As I'm speaking to you now, I'm in the court now answering for a suit that have been moved by the government against me, where I'm accused of violating state secrets. For me, this is all connected from the attempt of kidnapping me, this lawsuit against me, and now they are burning down our office.
Have you been able to report this incident to the police, and what are the police saying?
Yes, this particular incident of yesterday, I reported it to the police station. They say that they're going to investigate, but honestly, I can't believe that they're going to investigate because there is an ongoing investigation on my attempt kidnapping. And until today, they didn't say a word on that. And I don't believe also that something is going to happen. If something is going to happen, it's maybe a lawsuit against me again.
We know that Mozambique is in the middle of, we have the jihadists who are carrying out attacks in Mozambique. Is there any relationship in terms of what's going on in the country? I mean, I want you to talk about the level of press freedom.
First of all, this is attack is not related with jihad, but it's related with some kind of nervousism that's come from our government. Our government is responding very aggressively against the press on reporting things related with Cabo Delgado, things related with accountability. And the government is answering with violence. As I'm speaking now, we have a colleague that is missing in Cabo Delgado. We have colleagues that have been kidnapped. Our friend of our newspaper, Yassin Salema, have been broken his leg. And other things that are happening in short time. And we have never experienced this before.
Is your newspaper a daily or a weekly? And what are you going to do about printing in the next few days?
We have two newspapers. One of them is a weekly called Canal de Moçambique. It's a printed. And other one is a digital daily called Canal Moz. As they burn down our offices, we are trying so hard our best to print for Wednesday.
Matias Guante is executive editor of Canal de Moçambique newspaper. He was speaking with us from the capital, Maputo. Amnesty International has expressed concern that the Nigerian government has not been able to protect rural communities facing increasing attacks from gunmen. In its latest report, Amnesty says that at least 1,126 unarmed civilians have been killed since January this year. The report says residents in Kaduna, Katsina, Niger, Plateau, Sokoto, Taraba, and Zamfara states live in fear. This follows a sharp rise in insecurity in rural areas and incidents of abductions and violence carried out by gunmen. Amnesty International Programs Manager for Nigeria, Suwen Bakari, spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty about the report.
We have documented patterns of abuses and violations, both from gunmen who have been killing people without any restriction, and from the Nigerian government, particularly the security forces, who have failed in their duties to protect these people, and they have failed in their duties to bring perpetrators of these violations or these abuses against people to justice. So we interviewed civilians in places like Kaduna and Katsina, where the president himself comes from, and what we took away from all these interviews showed that it is government failing that have caused the death and the destruction of lives and properties that we are witnessing all across the northern part of the country.
Reading the report, you documented that the military officials are giving information of an impending attack, or the information given to them is not adhered to, and then they don't, you know, do anything about it. What can you tell me about this?
Many of the testimonies we gathered on the field are consistent with the fact that there were instances when the villagers knew of an impending attack, and then they would inform the security forces. And in certain instances, the security forces would not even show up at all. In instances where they showed up hours after these attacks have ended, and then they only come to count the dead bodies. We also have instances where security forces actually showed up while the attacks were ongoing, but when they saw the sophisticated ammunition that the attackers were using, then security forces withdrew their men.
Bashir, some government officials are on record that they've taken the fight to these armed groups, including Boko Haram militant groups, and that they are defeating them, although they've also incurred some casualties. So they sharply differ from the narrative of the report that Amnesty International has presented. And how do you reconcile these two?
Peter, you must understand that it is not enough for the government to say we are doing something. What we are saying is that the government is not doing enough, because if we are doing enough, then we should not continue to record this high number of deaths that we are recording. The government in some, for example, we give an example of Southern Kaduna, where the effort of the government was to increase checkpoints and to also declare a 24-hour curfew. But in spite of all these measures, the attacks have continued. So which tells us that there's so much more that the government needs to do. The duty to protect the people is a firm duty of the government, and no other person should take up this responsibility. So even when the government claims that they are doing so much, we are saying that there is so much more that needs to be done.
Sue Mbakari is Amnesty International Programs Manager for Nigeria. He was speaking to viewers Peter Clotty. A Senegalese delegation of health professionals visited Gambia over the weekend to exchange ideas with their counterparts. This as Gambia's coronavirus cases have surged from less than 200 a month ago to currently near 2,500 cases. Dr. Pa Amadou Sona, a surgical resident at the Edward Francis Small Teaching Hospital in Banjul, recently contracted coronavirus. He spoke to Ricky Stryak about the full-blown community transmission that is currently challenging the country.
I got sick last week. I started having fever, started having headache. So it took me about 4 days before I could get them to come to the house to collect my sample. It took another 3 days before I could get the results. Then I am almost really getting recovered most of the symptoms that I had.
As a healthcare worker in Gambia, what would you say are some of the biggest successes of the national response to the outbreak, as well as maybe some of the things that could have gone better from the beginning?
So I'll start with the with the problems. I think my personal perspective is that we should have done lot better than we have done. The major problem that we have is that we're able to get results done, tests done, and get your results in time to be able to deal with the patient amicably. In a sense that, I'll take myself as an example. I am a health worker. I am a senior civil servant. I know all the colleagues that are responsible for taking samples, isolations, and stuff. And it took me very tough to be able to get them in time. It took me 4 days to be able to get them to come and test me. Taking another 3 days, 7 days has lapsed before I could know my status. So if I were somebody who's not aware, who's not known about disease and stuff, I would have been out in the streets, probably if I were asymptomatic, out in the streets and be spreading it. And then that's one of the major problems that we're having currently. We are still under reporting because we are not doing enough tests to be able to pick out all the positive cases. So that is a major problem. Again, initially there was good control in the beginning from March when it broke out in Senegal. There was a complete lockdown, and then that had helped lost a lot of things in terms of controlling the spread.
Do you think that the continued lockdown or border closure measures are, while they may be helping public health, do you think they are possibly hurting people's ability to support themselves on a day-to-day basis?
I think we just locked down with the rest of the world. Now that we have loosened up, is the time that the community spread is really here. And I think one of the biggest challenges is having people walking around, going up and down, despite community transmission. So the suggestion would be to have a complete lockdown again, as we had in March, April, so that can help us to be able to contain the virus. It is true, on the average Gambian, we have a lot of people who are poor and depend on going out to the markets every day, going out to do whatever they do every day to be able to get food for the family. So shutting down completely is going to cause a lot of issues in terms of people's livelihood. And that is why the government had loosened over the time. But what we need to understand is that the government, like in other places, needs to come out and help the people in terms of finances, in terms of feeding, to be able to have them to stay at home.
That was Dr. Pa Amadou Sona, a surgical resident at the Edward Francis Small Teaching Hospital. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Gambia's capital, Banjul. And that's it for this Tuesday, August 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that you will have a very good day.